But before we get to the readings, to which I want to devote about half my time, there are a few things I want to say by way of introduction. The first of these is how I came to get involved with the subject of poetry as an art form having special meaning for women, and thus a study calling for our attention. For me, it became a fascination. I start with this personal note deliberately. Poetry, after all, is an academic subject in this most academic of places, or so it is characteristically treated. But to those of us who write it, it's how we live. I want to make it clear that I'm not going to tax you with a specialist's analytical approach. Poetry is identity. In today's dynamic struggle for liberation, it's the living material unsuited for studious dissection, though a case for the latter can be made. But I have other things to talk about, and nothing can equal the fact that poetry, as a kind of music, ought to be heard. Now for how I got started. 3 years ago, I decided, for my thesis requirement in English, to do a critical anthology of women poets. The idea actually came from an advisor whom I'd been sounding out on topics to do with women in literature. Off I marched to the library to see what had been done in this area. Almost unbelievingly, I found there was next to nothing, the catalog yielding only one small collection of love lyrics edited by Sarah Teasdale, a poet, in 1917. I can now report that in the time since I began my inquiries, one or two women's anthologies have made their public appearance, undoubtedly stimulated by the movement, so that the situation is beginning to improve. But 3 years ago, that was it. Interestingly enough, if I may digress on the subject of anthologies by sex, I found that it's often women poets themselves, especially ones who've achieved recognition, who are the most hostile to this idea. Such people strongly feel that poetry, as any art form, I suspect, should be seen and judged on its own merits and cannot nor should not be classified according to sex. Such segregation smells of the ghetto, they say, or at least implies criteria other than those of art, and they expect and want to be judged on the basis of art. Well, who doesn't? Who's involved with it? And I have to agree, poetry shouldn't be classified according to sex, but it is and always has been in certain past attitudes that are far from dead. Being of a rather exalted nature among the professions, poetry has been especially jealously regarded as a male prerogative in the past. In the English-speaking world, that remains the case up till the 17th century, at which time a woman breaks through, accomplishing a triumph for her sex and for all time. I'll come back to her presently. Since then, women have won a place of relative freedom in the arts, though grudgingly conceded. Yet the fact remains that, for all this room in which to spread, there has not been a comprehensive survey of their work made. Nor do women today in the 1970s appear in anything like equal proportion to the men in the numerous anthologies of poetry. To get back, when I first started to investigate the situation, I was disturbed by doubts and negative reflections. I was secretly convinced I might discover that women poets were just not up to the mark. And of course, I wanted desperately to believe otherwise, to believe, in fact, that sex made no difference in the universal impulse to art expression and the genius within it. So I started reading, researching. I began to wonder what it was exactly I was looking for. Did I have to prove something? It seemed to me that conducting a search for excellence was somehow elusively wide of the mark, besides being defensive. And to set myself up as a critic this early in the game was to fall into a trap. Yet I needed to select. There was far more material, good material, than I'd anticipated. It soon came to me that what I wanted really to find out was how women, in experiencing their lives, give shape to that experience as women and as artists. I've been slowly coming to realize how often we act out others' expectations of us instead of paying attention to who we really are and insisting on the validity of such perceptions of ourselves. Eva Figgis puts it this way in the opening paragraph of her book, Patriarchal Attitudes. The first thing that strikes one about the image in the mirror to which we dance is the fact that it was created by men. Not by men and women jointly for common ends, not by women for themselves, but by men. One could say that this is the real difficulty, the fact that the mirror is distorted. Man's vision of woman is not objective, but an uneasy combination of what he wishes her to be and what he fears her to be. How well illustrated this is in literature. Yes, I thought, from Homer onward, poetry sure hasn't told it from our side. Well, in literature, when you want to know the workings of a mind, you don't consult secondary sources, you go to the source itself. In going through hundreds of books, I made it my task to select out only those poems in which women deal with themselves biologically, sexually, in interaction with others, in socially defined roles, and as creative artists, where they define themselves, usually at the profoundest level. What did I find? Well, after collecting and going over no less than 400 poems to date, my most important single discovery is simply this, that there is a vigorously flourishing, abundant body of poetry and excellent good form and spirits, which speaks as none before it has ever spoken. That is, with authenticity of what it means to be a woman. And I think that's revolutionary, whatever else it is. So much for my personally inspired involvement with the subject, apart from being a poet myself. I want to spend some time now dwelling on women poets in history, going back to beginnings there, and maybe jumping around a bit. The historical context is peculiarly vital to an appreciation of where women stand today in poetry. I use the word peculiarly because of a kind of paradox. In history, we have no history there. At least not till comparatively recent times, except for the triumphant fact of Sappho, who lived 2,700 years ago and lives still. So that is a beginning, though we must leap from there to the 17th century world in England to establish a continuity. For languages other than English, it is a slightly shorter leap as we come to women who, like Christine de Pizan at the outset of the 15th century, began publishing as a part of the Renaissance sweeping Europe, which you'll remember took a while to reach England. In any event, a terrible lapse of centuries in which women are kept silent. Names of women poets do not begin to cluster till well into the 19th century, where they are still in pitiful small numbers compared with men. Relative to them, in our practice of poetry, we are still close to our beginnings. Well, you've all heard of Sappho, one of the great poets of all time, whose genius and fame have transcended the long blackout. In her own time, she was supreme. The ancient Greeks, centuries after her death, still honoring her as the greatest of all living poets, male and female. For Sappho was not the only woman to be writing, and in fact, the names of several others have come down to us, though their work is lost. Clearly, this was a world of fairly liberal attitudes toward the sex, particularly in the Eastern Greek society into which Sappho was born. In Athens, this was considerably less so, though Plato, as you'll recall from his Republic, advocated the equality of women. Sappho received from him a singular honor when he suggested in a poem of his own that she deserved the title of 10th Muse. Since then, historical judgment has added its own phrase. A modern critic puts her in perspective. To the masculine heroism of tradition, writes Werner Jaeger in Paideia, The Ideals of Greek Culture, Sappho's songs, quivering with the rapture of complete, harmonious friendship, added the nobility of the feminine soul. They depict an ideal third life between childhood and marriage, an age in which women were educated to attain the highest possible nobility of spirit. Alas, we may sigh for the relatively golden age of our sex. But notice within Jaeger's romantic turn of speech that marriage then, as so often even now, was the threshold that terminated the holiday, putting an end to the reaching and soaring of the feminine spirit. Yet Sappho was able to overcome the common lot, for she was married and had a daughter, which made no difference to her vocation. A poet among the Greeks was a teacher. And as a very distinguished one, Sappho ran a sort of women's commune to which parents sent their daughters. Here she taught them the foremost accomplishments of poetry and music. The association probably had its religious life, indispensable in those times, where the lyric arts and the dance served the gods. Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, is mentioned more often in the remaining verse fragments than any other deity or person. Sappho's relations with her students and companions was a loving one. Some she got to love passionately, in the full sense of the word. Socrates, another esteemed teacher, did no less. As an historian emphasizes in a foreword to the Barnstone translation of her work, love for young people, which is essential for a good teacher, quote, normally has a sexual component. Though that may be fiercely denied, and also certainly it is not the whole story, for instance, there is also a protective, parental feeling, unquote. All of which shows that the ancient Greeks were apparently far less hung up than we on the matter of loving, though they had their problems too. The point is that out of such close relationship came Sappho's poetry. Let me read you a sample. This is a poem about the pain of loving. You'll get the full savor of the last line better if you know that the giving of fine gifts in courtship was looked on with favor by the ancient Greeks. If you couldn't afford any, you might be at a disadvantage. And like Sappho here, feel yourself locked out of paradise or Olympus or mortality, same thing. To me, that man equals a god as he sits before you and listens closely to your sweet voice and lovely laughter, which troubles the heart in my ribs. For now, as I look at you, my voice fails. My tongue is broken, and thin fire runs like a thief through my body. My eyes are dead to light. My ears pound, and sweat pours down over me. I shudder. I am paler than grass, and am intimate with dying. But I must suffer everything, being poor. A quote from Jaeger again. No masculine love poetry among the Greeks even approached the spiritual depth of her lyrics, he claims. We see in them that Eros was a passion that shook its victim's whole being. It had an amazing power to grip and transform the whole personality, set free the vast sweep of emotions. Sappho's reputation, then as now, rests on her power to convey this ecstasy, as only poetry can. It captures the imagination to realize, along with Barnstone, who makes the observation, that in her we hear for the first time in the Western world the direct words of an individual woman. One, moreover, who emerges in her poetry as a completely realized personality. It cannot be said that her song has ever been surpassed, he says. Speaking of craft, the historian Moses Haddas, in A History of Greek Culture, tells us, quote, she wrote the dialect she spoke and owed nothing to a formal poetic tradition, unquote. Yet others credit her with technical innovations. These matters make one think. For a Sappho, if Sappho could spring full-blown out of these circumstances, perhaps it is not necessary to feel ourselves in want of a tradition as unbroken as men's in poetry. Certainly, with hardly a one, women are not in the least daunted by the lack. At this very moment, women are foremost in any list of leading Canadian poets, Americans too, and there are undoubtedly more women writing and publishing poetry in America alone today than in the whole of Western history, taking all ages together. Sappho celebrated the love of friends. When the poetry of love is taken over by men in the much later period of a Christian culture, it creates, for one thing, an abstract idealization of something called virtue, but mainly it's concerned with women's beauty and sexual desirability. There are a few great exceptions, like Shakespeare and Donne. For the rest, the courtly love lyric of Elizabethan and earlier times, though it put woman on a pedestal, actually concealed an attitude of enmity toward the sex. For by at least the late medieval period in Christendom, what was left of Eros, the great life-giving force, had been reduced to a dangerously ambivalent, mysterious power in women, which they exercised at whim. Frail creatures, they could witlessly inflict the suffering of frustration on a stricken lover, taking cruel pleasure in it besides. One can sympathize with the disdainful lady of the courtly laments for being in no hurry to compromise herself. For the minute she stopped being unkind, as they put it, which meant coming down off her pedestal, she was a dead duck, an unchaste woman who submitted to sexual temptations. The unfriendly aspects of this double standard are still with us, not least in literature. Sappho, having fallen victim to narrow moral forces in history, was for a long time expunged from the records and the major part of her work gradually destroyed. Some of it began to return to light in the Renaissance. It took a while for this to begin to mean something to women. When women take up the lyric tradition, getting closer to our own time, they do so from the men directly preceding them, often taking for their models male poets who romantically idealized their love object in Neoplatonic terms. But women tend not to abstract from the particular, as does Yeats, to take a modern example, when he imposes the symbol of Helen of Troy on the individual woman he loved. When women elevate a love object, he is always that particular man, praised, as in Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Sonnets from the Portuguese, for the qualities of character he himself is seen to possess. It is the same where a woman is the object in the sapphic tradition, as in many of the imagist poet Amy Lowell's poems. It is love itself, the relationship, that is idealized. Nowadays, in the growing revulsion toward the entire male tradition which romanticized women out of their real humanity, there is distinct lessening of the desire to speak of love in idealized terms. Edith Sitwell and Marianne Moore, two leading poets of the early part of our century, had little or nothing they cared to say on the subject. They even preferred not to get married, like a lot of other women poets before and since, one might add. Nonetheless, they were prolific. And one has only to read Margaret Atwood to be struck with the enormous backlash, the refusal to see Eros as life power, as love at all, the overlay of Christian mysticism not even existing for her. What she sees instead is a political power wielded by men still unwilling to relinquish their centuries-old dominance. On the other hand, there is Diane Wachowski, who loudly beseeches love in her untiring complaints against an archetypally rejecting male lover whom she courts. The romantic tradition, like God, dies hard. Love retains its grip on the human imagination, for which, if I may say so, I'm personally grateful. But I'm getting way ahead of myself chronologically. At the beginning of my talk, I mentioned a woman in the 17th century who managed to break through a literary scene of exclusive male domination to become a first in modern times. That woman was Aphra Behn. Her extraordinary personality and achievement has been brought to life in a biography written by George Woodcock and published in 1948 called The Incomparable Aphra, which I can't recommend to you highly enough. His generous admiration is refreshing. His style is lively, his scholarship's impeccable, and his subject is irresistible. He refers to her as, quote, the first great woman in English literature, giving it as his opinion that she, quote, equaled or surpassed the best of her contemporaries. In view of his regard for Dryden, this is praise indeed. Well, where is she in our curricula? In all my years as an undergraduate and then graduate student in the English department of this university, I never once heard her name mentioned or read about her in texts required by my courses. Though Woodcock is a scholar of international status working in our midst, it would appear that his teaching colleagues don't read him, or if they do, let inertia guide them in making the fruit of literary research available to their students. If there are exceptions, I apologize to the persons concerned. Anyway, here is Aphra, the first woman to earn her living by writing, despite being a monarchist, was a revolutionary in every important aspect. Who, says Woodcock? By sheer tenacity and good humor pushed into a male world, opening a way for the intellectual liberation of her own sex and presaging the end of human slavery. For in the course of establishing herself as a highly popular playwright, poet, novelist, and translator, as well as woman of wit, she left her mark on her age in several vital ways, as an opponent of marriage, as it was then perpetrated on women, as a pioneer in the cause against slavery, preceding abolitionists such as Harriet Beecher Stowe by nearly two centuries, and through her struggle against jealous male detractors, as a pioneer in the fight for women's emancipation. Dearest to the heart of a literary historian, she was an innovator in style and technique. Woodcock takes pleasure in tracing, quote, the beginnings of a number of changes in writing and thought that have had a real influence on the literary and social development of subsequent centuries. Woodcock is not the first to say these things. Virginia Woolf, in A Room of One's Own, informs us of our debt, pointing out that among other things, Afra became a model for women to earn money from their writing, and thus economic independence. Truly an event of great historic importance had occurred. By the end of the 18th century, women's writing was selling to an eager audience, and the activity was widespread. There was a gain in writing power, too. For, says Virginia in her fine, insightful way, masterpieces are not single, solitary births. They are the outcome of many years of thinking in common, of thinking by the body of the people, so that the experience of the mass is behind the single voice. And she pays homage to Afra by saying, all women together ought to let flowers fall on her tomb. It really is inconceivable when you think of it, that this admired friend of Dryden and other male luminaries of the Restoration period in which she figured so prominently should be so long ignored by critics, historians, and in our own, for lack of enterprise, dull sanctum. Fortunately, the movement has been catching up with such omissions, and articles are appearing which let us know at least how we have been deprived. The 17th century is notable not only for giving us Afra, but her elder contemporary, Anne Bradstreet, an Englishwoman who emigrated in the year 1630 to the New World to become its first poet of consequence. Her brother-in-law published her first work without her consent in London under a long title beginning, The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up in America. Notice how he echoes Plato's compliment in setting up his very own kinswoman as Sappho's equal. It is not till later, however, from 1650 on, in poems dealing with the domestic subjects, that her work matures and takes on life. Here are some comments by the poet Adrienne Rich in a foreword to Anne's collected works. Anne Bradstreet was the first non-didactic American poet, the first to give an embodiment to American nature, the first in whom personal intention appears to precede Puritan dogma as an impulse to verse. Her voice is direct and touching. In a time and place in which men and women were fighting for survival, an act of great self-assertion and vitality. To have written poems, the first good poems in America, while rearing eight children, lying frequently sick, keeping house at the edge of the wilderness, was to have managed a poet's range and extension within confines as severe as any American has confronted. End quote. Women wrote best, it would appear, when, like Sappho, who describes herself as poor, like Afra, who wrote from the necessity of earning a bare living, and like Anne, who struggled merely to stay alive in a harsh environment, they wrote of their daily life, personal and concrete, speaking out of their experience. But what a gulf of time between these voices, from the 7th century BC to the 17th AD, a silence of nearly 2.5 centuries. Slightly less, remembering Christine de Pizan, who so far seems to be the earliest European woman writer and poet to be heard. I must also not forget to mention Anne Finch of Winchelsea and Catherine Phillips, otherwise known as the matchless Arinda, talented contemporaries of Afra, though lacking in her drive, genius, and professional stature. There are undoubtedly others of whom I am ignorant. In any event, a tragically long, millennial dark age for women. With these precedents established, however, we begin to hear from others better known. Though Elizabeth Browning has been greatly, and I think unjustly, overshadowed by her famous husband Robert, she was in her own Victorian time more popular than he. Today, only her sonnets glorifying her love for Robert are circulated. More exciting, in my opinion, is her verse novel, Aurora Lee, which I guarantee you'll find at least more relevant, if you can find it, since unfortunately it's practically unavailable in bookstores. Look for it in the library under the collected works. Written well over a century ago, Aurora Lee is a self-portrait of a poet written in beautifully flowing blank verse. It is a study of the intellectual, emotional, and creative development of a woman who refuses to put love and marriage before the spiritual necessity of her own work. The book, writes Elaine Showalter in Women's Liberation Literature, shocked critics with its heroine's insistence on her need to define her own life and to do her own work rather than accept a man's vision of her, however affectionate, unquote. But the public was far ahead of the critics in its enthusiasm, and Elizabeth continued to write throughout her marriage, despite illness, four miscarriages, and the birth of a son. In her numerous works, she shows great compassion for women and children suffering poverty under the often horrifying conditions of the Industrial Revolution in England. Yet again, here is another great writer slighted, a major poet insultingly ignored or diminished. But in the 19th century, we come into our own with gathering strength. For besides Elizabeth, we also have the Bronte sisters, Christina Rossetti, and the original genius of Emily Dickinson, among others. Emily, whose fame has outdistanced any of her contemporaries, has been called, like Sappho, a pure poet, which is the critic's highest compliment. A co-editor of her works, A.L. Hampson, along with Martha Dickinson Bianca, the poems of Emily Dickinson, remarks that Emily, quote, was primarily interested not in form, but in what she had to say. Yet another critic, editor Daniel Hoffman in the introductory essay to his American Poetry and Poetics, notes that her imagery is taken from, quote, the woman's world of her house, her collars, her village landscape, and especially her religion, unquote. There is nothing from the masculine worlds of machinery, war, or shipwreck. Like her countrywoman Anne Beck Bradstreet, the first lady of American poetry, or perhaps in purity, uniqueness of expression, and concern for the intensely personal experience, more like the ancient mother of us all, Sappho. I wish I could quote from these poets too, but the pressure of time won't allow. From the end of the 19th century into our own, the names come on so fast it is hard to pay proper attention to each or to keep track chronologically. I've already referred to a few. Let me mention a few more of the older ones, taking names at random. H.D., as Hilda Doolittle was known, Edna St. Vincent Millay, Elizabeth Bishop, Isabella Valency Crawford, an early Canadian poet, Dorothy Livesey, who recently edited the first anthology of Canadian women poets, Margaret Avison. I must stop. Since there's plenty of information available and books galore, I leave it to you. In the accelerating pace of the present century, the world has witnessed an almost volcanic explosion of women poets. Hundreds we have heard from or are hearing for the first time, and hundreds yet to be heard from. Feminine voices like a burning fountain erupting from the depths of heavy centuries of imposed silence. This concludes my mini history, which is no more than an impressionistic stab at a huge area that needs intensive research. Yet just scratching at the surface convinces me we're on to something big. How shall I say it? Women didn't build churches, and outside of queens didn't govern states or lead interminable wars of aggression. But in poetry, women have always been the equals of men in highest achievement. It seems to me that when women recover this ancient heritage in full awareness of its meaning for us all, we, will begin to understand ourselves in a new and energizing way, as founders and shapers of a new, though hitherto unrecognized, tradition. This is the message I most want to leave with you. I think, too, it will enlarge the entire literary tradition, whose bias will have to be adjusted in taking us properly in. I have one more thing to say, and then we'll get on with the reading. We have just begun, collectively, to write with full candor and awareness of our feminine experience. Historically speaking, we've just begun to shape that experience from a point of view that doesn't assume male omniscience, but centers itself in our own particular bodies and psyches. But this business of no longer taking the patriarchal society for granted is so recent an event that we still, in a general way, tend to internalize the prejudice of ourselves as inferior. One of the effects of having been prevented from making our own art is that we are in the habit too often of judging ourselves solely by standards arrived at by men based on their work, without taking into consideration that our work must take time to evolve its own criteria. It is, after all, the product of conditions, sexual, social, and political, which up till now required specific behaviors from us, very different from those required of men. There's a positive aspect in this. Our strength seems to lie in the personal side. What women are doing with form today is at least as exciting as what they are saying through it in refusing to fit the dominant image of who or what we should be. We are learning to trust our own powers, which are the shape of our experience. Now for the readings. I've arranged the poems I'm going to read under the following headings, which cover major aspects of this experience. They are experiencing one's body, experiencing hatred of war, violence, and destruction, experiencing love in its sexual range and romantic overlay, marriage and motherhood, aging, anger at women's oppression, and finally experiencing the need to define oneself as artist. I won't have time to read more than from 2 to 5 in each category, and I've had to choose short ones. I'll begin first, though, with a poem by Margaret Atwood, which gives us the historic context in poetic terms of concise filmic vignettes. From Power Politics by Margaret Atwood. At first, I was given centuries to wait in caves, in leather tents, knowing you would never come back. Then it speeded up, only several years between the day you jangled off into the mountains and the day it was spring again. I rose from the embroidery frame at the messenger's entrance. That happened twice, or was it more? And there was once, not so long ago, you failed and came back in a wheelchair with a mustache and a sunburn and were insufferable. Time before last, though, I remember I had a good 8 months between running alongside the train, skirts hitched, handling you violets in at the window, and opening the letter. I watched your snapshot fade for 20 years. And last time, I drove to the airport still dressed in my factory overalls, the wrench I had forgotten sticking out of the back pocket. There you were, zippered and helmeted. It was 0 hour, you said, be brave. It was at least 3 weeks before I got the telegram and could start regretting. But recently, the bad evenings, there are only seconds between the warning on the radio and the explosion. My hands don't reach you. And on quieter nights, you jump up from your chair without even touching your dinner. And I can scarcely kiss you goodbye before you run out into the street and they shoot. Now for experiencing one's body. Women poets, far more than their male counterparts, speak very openly and unselfconsciously about their bodies, the sexual organs, and their biological functioning. Of course, such concerns as menstruation, childbearing, and nursing are supremely their own. So are breasts and vaginas, ultimately. And isn't it nice to have them? The Ballad of the Lonely Masturbator by Anne Sexton. The end of the affair is always death. She's my workshop, slippery eye, out of the tribe of myself, my breath finds you gone. I horrify those who stand by. I am fed. At night, alone, I marry the bed. Finger to finger, now she's mine. She's not too far. She's my encounter. I beat her like a bell. I recline in the bower where you used to mount her. You borrowed me on the flowered spread. At night, alone, I marry the bed. Take, for instance, this night, my love, that every single couple puts together with a joint overturning, beneath, above, the abundant two on sponge and feather, kneeling and pushing, head to head. At night, alone, I marry the bed. I break out of my body this way, an annoying miracle. Could I put the dream market on display? I am spread out. I crucify. My little thumb is what you said. At night, alone, I marry the bed. Then my black-eyed rival came, the Lady of Water, rising on the beach, a piano at her fingertips, shame on her lips, and a flute's speech. And I with the knock-kneed broom instead. At night, alone, I marry the bed. She took you the way a woman takes a bargain dress off the rack, and I broke the way a stone breaks. I give back your books and fishing tack. Today's paper says that you are wed. At night, alone, I marry the bed. The boys and girls are one tonight. They unbutton blouses, they unzip flies, they take off shoes, they turn off the light. The glimmering creatures are full of lies. They are eating each other, they are overfed. At night, alone, I marry the bed. A poem by Pat Lowther, Canadian poet, in which he confirms the joy of giving birth. It's an earth mother image reinforced by mythical overtones, which offers an alternative to man's destructiveness. May Chant by Pat Lowther. May, and I squat in labor, crying the child, come down. Surely I am only a partway unwound spiral of bloody cord, crying the child, come down from his male cross and others before him. Dionysus, come down. Osiris, come down. King of the kissing, killing, mistletoe, come down. It is the men who come, tall singing, John Barleycorn is dead. But it was my child, my husband they killed. And it is I, under the scalpeled earth, will cry the good of his blood and meat. Come down to the root of things, and I who will, in the darkness of germination, stealthily gather the scattered members and bind them whole. Dulles Lang, a poet now dead, in Afternoon Tea asserts sisterhood in its hatred of war. This is a poem that was written in 1939. Afternoon Tea. The dusky Chinese tea, tasting of shadow, hot from the thin cups, comforts our dry throats. Our thoughts are all of war. We speak our thoughts. The window opens on the sunlit meadow. The rusks are sweet. Our taste of them is bitter. Our tongues are heavy with a lost world's grief, as still we practice, for a short while safe, a lost world's rite of tea and toast and butter. A German woman and an English woman and a young Jewess in a neutral land, freed of our flags, we strive to comprehend the rupture of a world we love in common. The decorous room with sanity encloses our bodies, but our outraged thoughts are fled to cities where our sisters, screaming mad, hunt for small corpses in the wreck of houses. In this other poem by Dulles Lang, the maker is in a sense a response to the literature of gloom and despair as highlighted by T.S. Eliot, to whom the poet here alludes. The maker. It is the fashion to speak in the falling cadence of disillusion. The world ends with a whimper, not with a bang, and it is merely prudence thus to foretell and so to feel the temper of now and tomorrow. The poet being only the doctor to take the pulse and diagnose the ailment, always considering death the one known factor. I hate that falsehood. I hate the time's defilement of art by politics. It is the gift of the poet to contradict chaos, to hear the yes of the womb and loud along the ears of man to say it, making another space and a new time. Women have never had the social climate in which to speak out as frankly of themselves in sexual matters as they do today. So we have a refreshingly new approach to sexual love, which can no longer support the falsity of one-sided views or idealizations. A poem by Adrienne Rich called Two Songs. One, sex, as they harshly call it, I fell into this morning at 10 o'clock. A drizzling hour of traffic and wet newspapers. I thought of him who yesterday clearly didn't turn me to a hot field ready for plowing, and longing for that young man pierced me to the roots, bathing every vein, etc. All day he appears to me touchingly desirable, a prize one could wreck one's peace for. I'd call it love if love didn't take so many years. But lust, too, is a jewel, a sweet flower, and what pure happiness to know all our high-toned questions breed in the lively animal. Two, that old last act. And yet sometimes all seems post-coitum trees, and I a mere bystander. Somebody else is going off, getting shot to the moon. Or a moon race. Split seconds after my opposite number lands, I make it. We lie fainting together at a crater edge, heavy as mercury in our moon suits, till he speaks in a different language, yet one I've picked up through cultural exchanges. We murmur the first moon words, spasiba, thanks, okay. Poem by Canadian poet Sharon Stevenson called Lover's Anatomy, in which we have the love relationship from his and her viewpoints, like towels on the bathroom rack, I guess. Lover's Anatomy. You think me your own curling eyelash that follows every crisp of thought, every turn of body. I, in turn, see you as my toenail, useful, necessary to be clipped, if painful. An early 20th century poet, Babette Deutsch, in a poem called Marriage, as it feels to women. Not anymore, not ever while I live with you, shall I be single or whole. A wife is one who cannot cease to give flowers of her body and graftings from her soul. I came to bud for you like a young tree, and though I should not give you any fruit, here is one orchard where your hands make free. Something is always tugging at my root. Though you abandon what you once found sweet, I shall be like a birch whose bark is torn by finger-scratching, difficult, incomplete confessions of an outlived love and scorn. And though I wither near you, patiently as any bough that any wind can break, you will go on having as much of me as winter from a stricken limb can take. You are my winter as you are my spring. However we pretend, this will be true. You are the wind that makes the leafage sing and strips the branches that it quivers through. In this poem by Sylvia Plath, she depicts society as a marriage broker. It's called The Applicant. First, are you our sort of person? Do you wear a glass eye, false teeth, or a crutch, a brace or a hook, rubber breasts or a rubber crotch, stitches to show something's missing? No, no? Then how can we give you a thing? Stop crying, open your hand. Empty? Empty. Here is a hand to fill it and willing to bring teacups and roll away headaches and do whatever you tell it. Will you marry it? It is guaranteed to thumb shut your eyes at the end and dissolve of sorrow. We make new stock from the salt. I notice you are stark naked. How about this suit? Black and stiff, but not a bad fit. Will you marry it? It is waterproof, shatterproof, proof against fire and bombs through the roof. Believe me, they'll bury you in it. Now your head, excuse me, is empty. I have the ticket for that. Come here, sweetie, out of the closet. Well, what do you think of that? Naked as paper to start, but at 25 years she'll be silver, and 50 gold. A living doll everywhere you look. It can sew, it can cook, it can talk, talk, talk. It works, there is nothing wrong with it. You have a hole, it's a poultice. You have an eye, it's an image. My boy, it's your last resort. Will you marry it? Marry it. Marry it. But there is also celebration, as in this poet by Denise Levertov entitled The Wife. A frog under you, knees drawn up, ready to leap out of time. A dog beside you, snuffing at you, seeking scent of you, an idea unformulated. I give up on trying to answer my question, do I love you enough? It is enough to be so much here, and certainly when I catch your mind in the act of plucking truth from the dark surrounding nowhere, as a swallow skims a gnat from the deep sky. I don't stop to ask myself, do I love him? But laugh for joy. In a poem by an Australian poet, Gwen Harwood, we have the truth and fiction of motherhood. In the park. She sits in the park, Her clothes are out of date. Two children whine and bicker, tug her skirt. A third draws aimless patterns in the dirt. Someone she loved once passes by, too late to feign indifference to that casual nod. How nice, etc. Time holds great surprises. From his neat head unquestionably rises a small balloon, but for the grace of God. They stand a while in flickering light, rehearsing the children's names and birthday. It's so sweet to hear their chatter, watch them grow and thrive, she says to his departing smile. Then nursing the youngest child, sits staring at her feet. To the wind she says, they have eaten me alive. And here we have Myth and Reality with a quotation from Yeats. Young poet Mona Van Dyne in the poem Leda with a quotation. Did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beat could let her drop? Not even for a moment. He knew for one thing what he was. When he saw the swan in her eyes, he could let her drop. In the first look of love, men find their great disguise, and collecting these rare pictures of himself was his life. Her body became the consequence of his juice, while her mind closed on a bird and went to sleep. Later, with the children in school, she opened her eyes and saw her own openness and felt relief. In men's stories, her life ended with his loss. She stiffened under the storm of his wings to a glassy shape, stricken and mysterious and immortal. But the fact is, she was not for such an ending, abstract enough. She tried for a while to understand what it was that had happened, and then decided to let it drop. She married a smaller man with a beaky nose and melted away in the storm of everyday life. And here's a poem in which a married woman talks of aging. It's by leading American black poet, Gwendolyn Brooks, and it's called A Sunset of the City. Already I am no longer looked at with lechery or with love. My daughters and sons have put me away with marbles and dolls, are gone from the house. My husband and lovers are pleasant and somewhat polite, and night is night. It is a real chill out, the genuine thing. I am not deceived. I do not think it is still summer because sun stays and birds continue to sing. It is summer gone that I see. It is summer gone. The sweet flowers in drying and dying down. The grasses forgetting their blades and consenting to brown. It is a real chill out. The fall crisp comes. I am aware there is winter to heed. There is no warm house that is fitted to my need. I am cold in this cold house, this house whose washed echoes are tremulous down lost halls. I am a woman and dusty, standing among new affairs. I am a woman who hurries through her prayers. Tin intimations of a quiet core to be my desert and my dear relief come. There shall be such islandings from grief, and small communion with the master shore, twang they. And I incline this ear to tin, consult a dual dilemma, whether to dry in humming pallor or to leap and die. Somebody muffed it, somebody wanted to joke. To the category of anger, and here is Edna St. Vincent Millay, one of the older poets and one of the greatest, in my opinion, sonneteers of this century. Sonnet number 41 speaks with anger of the sex role imposed on women. I, being born a woman and distressed by all the needs and notions of my kind, am urged by your propinquity to find your person fair, and feel a certain zest to bear your body's weight upon my breast. So subtly is the fume of light designed to clarify the pulse and cloud the mind, and leave me once again undone, possessed. Think not for this, however, the poor treason of my stout blood against my staggering brain. I shall remember you with love, or season my scorn with pity. Let me make it plain. I find this frenzy insufficient reason for conversation when we meet again. Joyce Carol Oates, the outstanding novelist, speaks in anger against men for cutting women up into images they want to make of them in a poem called Pain. Conversational pity urged me on and gave me funds. Your intimacy was false, like garments flung down to music. Learn to smoke before a mirror, you said. Get rid of corny gestures. I think, I know, I want, you said. Pain once felt is felt always. Never mind the limbs wrapped about one another, stirred of themselves, muscles timed and pre-thought. Never mind half-lies. But where are the true sins? Not in pain, but in song. The tinkle of knives is true, my friend, and we who pass through here die and rise and live pinkly again, buttoning dresses that look familiar, powdering cheeks, forehead, sweaty nose. One abortion is pretty much like another. It is the mind that holds them, events crashing through time, through years. A mind like blue, no anesthetic, is totally vomited away. Symbols rise about me tonight, words. Now no symbols, but things, heavy tables rooted to floors, very safe. Doors never open by themselves, no police. Windows look to no future, and mirrors have not much to say. Symbols? What are symbols? What are your words? Think, you said. Can't you think? Think! Now I think, but not of you and not of men, surgeons with perpetual knives. I think of my song only, which is a song of hate, ill with sins of no fever, no belief, only prepared dirge of scooped out babies prepared. A woman, I think of no symbols, recall none, have no thoughts, feel pain. Symbols belong to men. There are no symbols. There is only pain. Denise Levertov again in a poem called The Mutes, in which he displays a very characteristic compassion along with protest and some despair. The Mutes. Those groans men use passing a woman on the street or on the steps of the subway to tell her she is a female and their flesh knows it, are they a sort of tune? An ugly enough song sung by a bird with a slit tongue, but meant for music? Or are they the muffled roaring of deaf mutes trapped in a building that is slowly filling with smoke? Perhaps both. Such men most often look as if groan were all they could do, yet a woman, in spite of herself, knows it's a tribute, as if she were lacking all grace, they'd pass her in silence. So it's not only to say she's a warm hole. It's a word in grief language, nothing to do with primitive, not an language. Language stricken, sickened, cast down in decrepitude. She wants to throw the tribute away, disgusted and can't. It goes on buzzing in her ear. It changes the pace of her walk. The torn posters and echoing corridors spell it out. It quakes and gnashes as the train comes in. Her pulse, sullenly, had picked up speed, but the car is slowed down and jarred to a stop while her understanding keeps on translating. Life after life after life goes by without poetry, without seemliness, without love. Again, Levertov, who in this poem is the artist serenely affirming her womanhood. Stepping westward. What is green in me darkens, muscadine. If woman is unconstant, good, I am faithful to ebb and flow. I fall in season, and now is a time of ripening. If her part is to be true, a north star, good, I hold steady in the black sky and vanish day by day, yet burn there in blue or above quilt of cloud. There is no savor more sweet, more salt, than to be glad to be what? Woman, and who myself I am, a shadow that grows longer as the sun moves, drawn out on a thread of wonder. If I bear burdens, they begin to be remembered as gifts, goods, a basket of bread that hurts my shoulders but closes me in fragrance. I can eat as I go. In the black art, Anne Sexton differentiates between men and women poets. A woman who writes feels too much, those trances and portents, as if cycles and children and islands weren't enough, as if mourners and gossips and vegetables were never enough. She thinks she can warn the stars. A writer is essentially a spy. Dear love, I am that girl. A man who writes knows too much. Such spells and fetishes, as if erections and congresses and products weren't enough, as if machines and galleons and wars were never enough. With used furniture, he makes a tree. A writer is essentially a crook. Dear love, you are that man. Never loving ourselves, hating even our shoes and our hats, we love each other, precious, precious. Our hands are light blue and gentle. Our eyes are full of terrible confessions. But when we marry, the children leave in disgust. There is too much food and no one left over to eat up all the weird abundance. Here's a little poem by myself from a suite of poems as yet unpublished and called This Woman, which is something of an apotheosis for me of identification with feminist outrage and identification. Number 9 from This Woman. Don't be misled, I told a friend on the phone. I'm not a bleeding stone, although I've bled. Rolled too many a mossless day, both girls and boys in the hay. She makes love just like a woman, but she breaks just like a little girl. And don't they love us for it? Till we stop the little boy who with such curious tenderness pulls the wings off butterflies. Scientist for the good of mankind. Look, I said, I'm not your mother. I'm not your wife of Bath. I'm not a class of women or your lover. Hell, I'm just a fucking real good poet. And finally, Ars Poetica. We're getting into our obscene stage here. By Erica Jong. It delightfully makes fun of the too earnest approach, which I've enough exemplified tonight, and is perhaps a dig at how poetry is taught. She gives us a recipe and instructions as per a sex manual. Ars Poetica. 1. Item. The poet has to feed and fuck